From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world, I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, superstitions. I can't wait for your calls. Here's what's happening. California woman has been arrested after she left two babies, a nine-month-old and a one-year-old, inside a steaming hot car while she shopped at a Walmart in Ontario, California. Wow. The 34-year-old woman was arrested after a security guard noticed a group of people gathered around a white SUV in the store's parking lot. He went up there to, hey, what's going on here? Inside, the two children, in distress due to the high temperatures. Sunday, they reached nearly 100 degrees in Ontario, California. Gee, folks, when you go shopping, bring your kids with you. Don't lock them in the car or your pets. In Tennessee, E. coli has been found in water at a zip line attraction after nearly 550 visitors to the attraction reported illness. Authorities think the estimate may be low. Initial tests confirmed the presence of E. coli and other bacteria in a well water sample at the Climb Works zip line canopy tour. People who became ill drank water served out of coolers along the course, and of course they were very thirsty. Now, some of you have been asking about the toxicology report on the death of Art Bell, who died April 13th. Well, so far, nothing. The coroner says they still do not have the toxicology test results back. We'll keep checking. It's taking a long time, and if we get the results, we'll definitely share them with you. NATO leaders pledging their unwavering commitment to boost defense spending following stern words from President Trump criticizing European leaders for spending too little. The U.S. and European allies signed a declaration stating that they are committed to improving the balance of sharing the costs and responsibilities of alliance membership. And for President Donald Trump, a summit with Vladimir Putin, according to some, risks of political backlash here at home and abroad. That's what some say. For the Russian president, however, the fact that the summit is even happening is already a big geopolitical win for him. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com, with us. John, what do you think of all of this? I think it's a good idea to meet with Putin.
Well, before we get to Putin, can I just make a comment about the summit in NATO?
Yeah.
John Kerry was out today just savaging Trump. And saying, you know, that, well, when he was in the White House, when he was the Secretary of State with President Obama, they went about their business very quietly, quiet diplomacy, backroom deals to try to get them to pay. Well, we all know they NATO didn't pay their fair share. But apart from that, Kerry's got no problem at all in the most vociferous diplomacy of denouncing an existing sitting president on foreign soil, negotiating on behalf of the United States to improve the U.S. condition. But he has no problem savaging his own president, but his diplomacy is very quiet when it comes to NATO. They have the utmost regard. Now, with respect to Putin, and this is the point that Trump made, George, this was the most important point that Trump made to Angela Merkel and to Germany. They're saying, you're so concerned. Let's face it. It's been 70 years since they started NATO. The purpose of NATO was to stop what looked like an inexorable advance by the Soviet Union over Eastern Europe and then potentially Western Europe. So they created a defense shield. Well, guess who is one of the biggest patrons in the Western alliance in the EU of Russia? It's Germany. They buy some 60 to 70% of their natural gas from Russia and petroleum and other energy products. So you can't have it both ways, that Russia is the big bad wolf and the enemy, and then be in bed with the big bad wolf and the enemy. And that's what Trump pointed out, you know, to many of the ministers. And I think a light bulb went off and they were saying, you know something? This guy's got a pretty good point here. You know, if we really believe that NATO is necessary to combat an advance by now the Russian Federation, as we saw in 2014 when he invaded Crimea, then, you know, they shouldn't be doing quite as much business with Russia and turning that state into, you know, energy billionaires.
And, of course, the meeting with Putin, good or bad?
Oh, I think it's outstanding that he's meeting with Putin. And of course, he'll be accused of conspiring with Putin in order to make some kind of a deal or whatever. But the reality is the global certain conditions, which we talk about linkage, and that goes to North Korea. It goes to Syria. It goes to every hot spot on the globe where Russia has a presence and can have an impact, including, by the way, on trade deals with China, which are really heating up right now, George. We saw the market drop precipitously today. There's great worry, you know, anxiety in these markets right now.
You heard
Mohamed El Arian today, one of the leading economists in the country with Allianz bond trading group, saying basically that the trade war that the U.S. has with China right now is going to improve the situation. Now, he's a very respected economist saying that this is not a bad thing like everybody thinks it is. It's going to force China to treat the U.S. With a little bit more parity and not take advantage of the country.
John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Well, they say it began with great expectations, an eagerly anticipated meeting with a reclusive leader and a gift bag that included an Elton John CD, but it ended with a scuttled rendezvous, statements declaring disappointment and stalemate. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's overnight visit to North Korea last week failed to demonstrate any progress on denuclearization talks, leading one source with knowledge of the discussions to say the White House felt it went as badly as it could have gone. Dr. Jerome Corsi, let's check in with him on this. Well, Jerry, things with North Korea aren't as friendly as we thought they were going to be.
Well, George, I think it's going to take time. I mean, the reality of denuclearization is going to have to, you know, what it means to North Korea, what it means to us. I think the United States would like to have rapid denuclearization, and North Korea would like it to take a lot of time. One key point, the last missile test that North Korea did was in November 2017. So there's clearly signs of progress, and Pompeo's trip, I think, brought reality to North Korea, and that President Donald Trump is not going to be easily bamboozled. He's going to demand progress, and the three aircraft carrier groups that were outside, you know, the naval waters outside North Korea could easily return. So North Korea's got some choices to make, and I think the Pompeo meeting was the beginning of reality for North Korea.
Jerry, your book, Killing the Deep State, is going crazy. It's on fire.
Thank you, George. It has been a New York Times bestseller for a month. It's been selling solidly since it came out in March, about March 15th. And it's been one of my best-selling books. And thank you for bringing that up. I really appreciate it.
And saw you on Newsmax TV. You do a great job there, too.
Well, thank you, George.
You're having fun.
I'm creating a new website, CorsiNation.com, which will be out here pretty soon.
Okay, my friend. Thanks. Dr. Jerome Corsi. Scientists say they found the earliest evidence of a human presence outside of Africa. Ancient tools discovered in China suggest primitive humans were in the region as early as 2.12 million years ago. They're about 270,000 years older than the previous earliest evidence. Pretty interesting. Michael Cremo, of course, would say they're much older. A strange animal was discovered floating along shore a beach in China. We've got the story in our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com. The mutant-looking human looks like a sea creature, but it's weird. Locals were scared to approach it at first. Then one man picked it up to get a photo next to it. When he did, he was left stunned as the animal, or whatever it is, began moving its head and limbs. Go take a look at it. It's at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, Professor Stephen Cohen joins us. We're going to talk about these events happening at the NATO summit and how it affects all of us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Our special guest for the next couple hours, Professor Stephen Cohen, Professor of Russian Studies and History Emeritus at NYU, Professor of Politics Emeritus at Princeton University. He is among the most distinguished scholars of Russian history in the United States. I turn to him quite often for these stories about Russia and the United States. And tonight we're going to be talking about the NATO summit and some other important issues that face all of us. Now, some of you have already sent me emails saying, are you folks going to be pro-Trump, against Trump? It's not about that. It is not about that. It is about what is happening on this planet as it affects the United States and subsequently as it affects you. And, Stephen, we got to get a lot of people to understand that.
You said it best. It's not about Trump, first and foremost. It's about all of us. overshadowing. And I know you want to talk about NATO, and we should, but the media coverage has been to frame the NATO visit, which was, yesterday and today?
Yeah.
To frame that as the prelude to the meeting with Putin on Monday. So the two have been linked, and probably rightly so, but it's kind of ominous coverage, as one of your guests before said. The theme is that Trump will sell out our allies, that means the NATO folks, to Putin on Monday. That's preposterous, but that is the mainstream media coverage. And I find it hard to deal with. I'll tell you why, if I could tee it up for us and you see what's worth talking about. There's only one advantage of getting older, and that is that you have a memory of history that's relevant that never seems to be considered by the mainstream media. Going to see Putin or having a summit by President Trump is anything but unusual. The first summit in history was Franklin Delano Roosevelt's historic trip to Yalta in 1943, during World War II, to meet Stalin. Churchill was there, too. Imagine how hard it was for Roosevelt, who could not walk, to make that trip by plane, I think train, boat, and car to Yalta. Right. But that was the first. After that, if I'm not mistaken, every American president had at least one summit meeting with the Kremlin leader, Soviet and post-Soviet. And several, Clinton, Eisenhower, a few others, had several such meetings. So what Trump is doing is anything but unusual. It's been done since the dawn of the nuclear age, primarily to be sure that the United States and Russia, the two nuclear superpowers, don't intentionally or accidentally go to war.
Well,
that's always been the primary purpose of these.
Why do they seem to be, and I'm talking about the media now, seem to be so into the fact that he's meeting with Russian president like it's a sin? I don't get it. I mean,
I've studied this carefully, and though I can't fully explain it, I know what it is.
And they also, and let me just say this, Stephen, even before the election, it was as if you can't meet with any foreign leaders when you're running for president. I would think that if I were running for president, I'd want to meet as many other country leaders before the election to try to tell them what my platform is, what I plan to do. And if I'm elected, we know each other already. I don't see anything wrong with that.
Well, I got to disagree with you a little bit on that. There's been the tradition, maybe it's not a good tradition, maybe what you say would be a better tradition, that when you're running for president, you should not meet with foreign leaders because you're trespassing on the legitimate territory of the sitting president. And you're saying essentially to a foreign leader,
if you meet someone at a party and you...
No, I don't mean that, but I...
Well, I know, but it's...
actual sit-down.
I don't see anything wrong with it.
Well, here's what they say. I'm not saying it's right, but we should understand. It's worth thinking about. You're running for president, and you're a credible candidate. You may be president. Before the election, you meet with a foreign leader. Essentially, you're saying without opening your mouth, pay no attention to the current president because you'll be dealing with me in 6, 5,
right.
or 3, 2 months.
Isn't that what Reagan did?
Reagan did not, I don't think. But here's where Trump has been falsely accused. And in fact, his first national security advisor, General Michael Flynn, I think was bushwhacked into a felony conviction. Once you're elected, you're called president-elect. We agree on that?
Yes, I agree with that.
And it's about, 2 months prior to taking office.
Yep.
During that period, it is considered legitimate to reach out to foreign governments. It's usually called the back door. And in regard to Russia, the Soviet Union, every president, going back at least to Nixon, possibly to Eisenhower, we aren't sure, had a back door to the Kremlin after they were elected, but before they became president.
Okay.
Trump is being accused, and his sons, and his national security advisor, of doing something illegal by seeking a back door to Putin. But it was normal. I mean, Kissinger did it for Nixon and actually used a Russian spy and used the Soviet communications network because he didn't trust the American one. So it is well-established practice. And Trump has got a completely bum rap on this one.
But, I mean, is it illegal to meet with a foreign leader before you're elected?
It's not illegal. But, you know, certain things are legal but aren't done, George. You would agree with that. There's common law practice. And I don't think it's a bad idea. I mean, if you're running for president, George, and it looks like you're going to win, you can wait until your electoral victory to open your diplomatic lines of contact with foreign states. You still have 2 months before you take office. It's just it's the messages that science. It's as though don't pay any attention to who's currently in the White House, even though they may have important foreign policy business to do during their remaining 6 months. Pay attention to me. That would be a confusing message to send. It's a minor point, and nobody would have paid any attention except for this crazy Russiagate, because one of the charges against the Trump campaign is that it had backdoors to Russia, and it did, but after Trump's election. You remember ABC misreported this story.
Right, it caught them, too.
And they fired the correspondent. That's
right.
Big a deal this was.
Exactly.
So this is not a light matter. It's something that has gotten lost in this Russiagate narrative, which is so full of fictions that every day we have to kind of tap ourselves on the head.
Has,
what are they talking about?
Has that tainted the upcoming meeting between President Trump and Vladimir Putin now?
It has, and that's actually the message I want to deliver to you and your listeners tonight, and I'll do it very briefly. In my judgment, the relationship between the United States and Russia today is more dangerous than it's ever been, at least since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, and maybe more dangerous than that, because these new Cold War fronts, where we're eyeball to eyeball militarily with Russia, are fought with war. That would be the Baltic region, where NATO is building up. That would be Ukraine, and that would be Syria. So it is exceedingly dangerous. It's imperative, not necessary or good or wise, but imperative, that Trump and Putin sit down and try to walk back some of these confrontations. But now comes your point, and this is unprecedented. Even though every American president has had a meeting with a Kremlin leader, none has departed with the charge that he's somehow compromised by or an agent of the Kremlin when he leaves. So none has ever been said to be potentially a traitor to American interests or to our allies. So this is new. This is the burden Trump carries, and this is the burden he will have to deal with when he tries to agree with Putin to walk back this new Cold War. It's unprecedented,
it is
dramatic, and it could be tragic.
In my concern, Stephen, again, it's not the politics of this. It's not Donald Trump or anybody else that would have been in office. It's this country and its relationship with other countries and to get things growing. I have never experienced in my career so much animosity that I've witnessed, so much bitterness, so much hatred, so much confusion, so much change in an administration than I can remember. I just don't get it. It's bizarre.
Among whom? You mean rank and file folks?
Everybody.
Well, the elite perpetuates this, the people who govern us. They have created this narrative of Russiagate.
They must love it.
But what do you think about I never use the word ordinary people because, you know, everybody is distinct in some way. But what about folks down home? Do they buy into this?
I think there's a mixed camp of people who are very bitter at what's being done to this administration. And then you've got another half that just wants him out.
Yes.
I'm getting emails. I get emails from both sides. I mean, if I put, and you just heard Dr. John Curtis. Dr. Curtis is a pro-Trump person. You put him on, I'll get a slew of emails from people who just can't stand that. And then when I have someone on like Howard Bloom, I get the other side. I'll be back. Well, I'm really looking forward to going to Asheville, North Carolina for our live state show Saturday, August 25th. It's really going to be fun. Looking forward to it. And I hope you're going to be there, too, especially if you live in that area. How do you get your tickets? Well, you can go straight to coasttocoastam.com. At the top of the homepage, click events, and then you click the little picture of the Asheville event and take it away, and then pick out your own seats. There's a few good ones left on the bottom, and then there's some great ones at the top on the balcony, and there's some handicap seats available for you, too. So we've got it all for you Saturday, August 25th. Some great guests, including Joshua P. Warren. We're going to have our meet and greet after the event, and it's going to be fun. It's at the DW Theater, the Diana Wortham Theater. Just go to events at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're with Professor Stephen Cohen talking about U.S.-Russian relations, how it affects all of us, the NATO summit, and some other issues as well. Stephen, let's get back into this in terms of the relationship. And you're correct. I mean, I remember during the 60s when I was in school, we'd have these fallout shelter bomb scare tests where they'd put us under desks and say, crouch into a little ball and just stay there for a little bit. And I kept saying to myself, how's a bomb not going to get me from this?
And you remember nuclear bomb shelters?
Yes.
Sold commercially and became a pretty good business. I grew up in Kentucky, and folks in that small town, a few folks built them in the backyard. The horses used to graze above them, but I always worried about what they were going to do with the horse in case of a nuclear war. You want to talk a minute about NATO? Because
yeah, I want to get your take on
things have gotten a little out of...
I mean, he's getting slammed because we're paying a lot of the money, the bills, and he wants some parity here.
He does, but it's even worse than that. Trump drives everybody crazy. But the subject he raised it briefly during the campaign in his own way, and now he's raised it again, meeting with these folks, the other NATO leaders in Brussels. And essentially he said, what exactly is the mission of NATO today? And is it worth all the money spent on it? And if so, you folks have to pay more because you're the ones who are in Europe. Now, this conversation, George, you will remember, began publicly in Washington and in the newspapers and on TV right after the Soviet Union ended in 1991, because NATO's purpose had been to contain and deter the Soviet Union.
That's right.
And the Soviet Union was no longer, and immediately people said, because the Russians had proposed that their bloc, the Warsaw Bloc, which was now disintegrating, and NATO both be abolished, and a new, what the Russians called, pan-European security arrangement, including Russia, be created in their place.
Which probably was a good idea.
It probably would have been, but instead, and a lot of our problems go back to Bill Clinton, and I confess that I voted for him at least once, go back to him, because by 1994, he decided the opposite, that he would expand NATO to Russia's border. So NATO was given a new mission, not to deter the Soviet Union, but to march to Russia's borders, where it sits today. And a lot of the turmoil we've had in American-Russian relations, in Ukraine, in Georgia, in the Baltic regions, has come from this military alliance moving to Russia's borders. But the question hasn't gone away. Is that NATO's only mission? Now, they write in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and I'm flabbergasted to see this phrase. It's like a religious incantation. NATO is the greatest military alliance in history. Well, I don't recall NATO as an alliance ever having fought a single war.
I don't think so either.
I don't. I asked my wife the other night because her memory. I said, "What are they talking about? I mean, glorious battlefield victories. When were they?" So NATO did some police action in the Balkan Wars of the 1990s, but that hardly qualifies as a great military victory. Some NATO countries, you remember, somebody called them the Coalition of the Willing, joined the Bush administration in its war on Iraq. And the Obama administration in its war on Libya. But they were catastrophes. The only place where NATO, some countries, have made a commitment is in Afghanistan. But most have gone home, and it has become American war in history. So where, what do they mean when they say the greatest military alliance in history? So I clicked on NATO on my computer today, thinking you and I might talk about it. And it confirmed what I know. That NATO might be the greatest corporate bureaucracy in history. They have just built themselves in Brussels a $1.2 billion new complex of buildings. They have 4,000, according to their website, 4,000 employees, non-military. So if a young person is looking for a job, I'm not advocating this, and you go to NATO application, it looks just like the application for General Motors or...
Yeah.
Or, I mean, it is a business, George. It is a big business. And where NATO goes, the economy flourishes because American money, troops, infrastructure come. Now, this is apart from the actual fighting forces of NATO, which is what Trump is talking about. But if Trump had a look why he's in Brussels, he's got to see it. They're inside this complex. And he looked at this. They dwarf all the Trump towers put together. He may wonder, what the heck are these people doing? This is a very good, cushy, profitable corporate arrangement. And no wonder they don't want to discuss what their mission is, because it might be no more than profit.
Huh.
I mean, it's a question I'm asking.
Our profit, our money that they probably keep.
And yet, we get it back. Let's be fair. Every you know that NATO countries, members, excuse me, have to have standardized military equipment.
Let me give out the member numbers right here for a moment, Stephen. They're Albania, Belgium, Bulgaria, Canada, Croatia, Czech Republic, Denmark, Estonia, France, Germany, Greece, Hungary, Iceland, Italy, Latvia, Lithuania, Luxembourg, Montenegro, the Netherlands, Norway, Poland, Portugal, Romania, Slovakia, Slovenia, Spain, Turkey, United Kingdom, and the United States. They're the members.
I feel much safer, I don't know about you, knowing that Montenegro is a member of NATO.
That's right. And
it was the most recent one.
And Lithuania. They're in there to help us.
And the NATO leadership, spurred on by the Brits and the Americans, has its eye on Ukraine and Georgia. In other words, the idea of expansion continues. But one other thing, to be fair, so folks can stop and think, we do get something in return, which Trump doesn't mention. When a country joins, it has to buy military equipment that conforms to NATO standards.
And they buy it from us, don't
well,
they?
Well, not all of it, but I would guess about 75%.
That's
so
a lot.
It's very good business for our weapons manufacturers. So if you believe that our, quote, defense industry are a vital part of our economy, you might talk yourself into being in favor of NATO and its expansion, because as it expands, the market for our weapons grows. So this whole debate that Trump has raised is very legitimate. The problem is that these people don't see Trump as legitimate. Would you agree with me on that?
I agree with that, and maybe it's the way he does it. Maybe he's too brash.
Maybe. But, I mean, still, we're grown up. If a guy says something sensible, he says something sensible.
I mean, he's right. I mean, the NATO folks who aren't paying, as far as I'm concerned, they're like deadbeats.
Well, he did something funny today or yesterday. I don't know if you noticed it. You know how he says he's a great deal maker?
Right.
He did what great deal makers do. You know, they're supposed to pay 2% of their GDP into military.
Right. Now he wants it to 4.
But wait a minute. In fact, on average, they were paying 1.5, right?
All right.
So he started complaining. Everybody should pay 2. And basically, they did nothing. So he said today, okay, we'll make it 4. So it's like the person who's trying to sell you a car. And he says, until Friday, it'll cost you $3,000. On Saturday, it'll be $5,000.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, he told him, if you're going to delay it,
it's going up.
It to 4. Yeah. So, but, you know, to mock Trump or attack him for attacking our allies is unfair, because these issues have been raised, George, since the Soviet Union ended in the 1990s, and they have not been answered. Does NATO have a legitimate mission? If it does, let's define it, and let's figure out how to fund it. Should Europe have its own army? I mean, that's essentially what Germany's saying. It can't do it because the German people won't pay for it. But some people in Europe have said, okay, you know, if the Americans don't like NATO, we'll create a European army, an EU army. I don't think it's plausible, but it's a talking point. But is NATO needed at all? And if it is, what's its mission? Just to march to Russia's borders and be provocative? And having that conversation is vital, that the moment Trump raises it, because so many people see him as illegitimate, the question becomes illegitimate.
Yeah, it's an issue. Now, for the person at home who's listening to this saying, what do I care about NATO? What would you say to them?
I would put it like this, and this is going to be provocative, and people are going to get angry, and I'm going to get all those emails, but we need to talk the truth as best we can see it. I don't claim to have a monopoly on truth, but I've been doing this 45 years, and I got a pretty good record. NATO exists today in its present enormous swollen form for one reason, the so-called Russian threat. It doesn't even profess any other. It doesn't fight terrorism to any degree. It doesn't have any military fronts. It's created what's now its new Eastern Front, as Germany used to call it during World War II. And everything's geared to the Russian threat. Everybody, they say that the Russian threat was demonstrated when Russia annexed Crimea. Crimea has absolutely nothing to do with Eastern Europe. Zero. Crimea was an exceptional case, and it was provoked by the Kremlin's fear that NATO expansion was coming for Crimea. The site, the location of Russia's historic naval base. If you take Crimea out of the equation, or Ukraine, where NATO has been provoking Russia for at least since the mid-1990s, the folks at home ask themselves, I'll put it like this, does Russia represent any threat that we ourselves have not created? I mean, you look at Russia today trying to recover from its collapse in the 1990s, desperately trying to rebuild, to pay pensions, to modernize, to transform its universities into world-class universities. People say Putin wants the Baltic countries, Latvia, Lithuania, right, and Estonia.
Do you think that's true?
Of course not. I mean, what does he want them for? He'd have to pay the pensions there. He's having trouble paying pensions
in
Russia.
Yeah.
You know what happened, by the way? You heard what happened in Russia about pensions? Very relevant to what we have here. Russia's pension age, let me get this right, has been since the 1930s, 60 for men and 55 for women. The lowest of any modern societies, I think. While people now are living longer and longer, on average to 73. So Putin has said, though he's made somebody else say it because it's exceedingly unpopular in Russia, we are going to gradually, over about 10 years, raise pension ages to, I think, I mean, I don't want to get this wrong, 60 and 65.
Right. As we did.
Well,
Social Security went up.
Yeah, that's right. And we're not obliged to take our pension, by the way, when we turn a certain age. We can decline it and get more.
And get more later.
Yeah, we do have to take the Medicare, and they'll deduct us for that. So I didn't start taking my pension when I turned 65. I was still working, and I figured, better wait, I'll get more, and if I die, the widow benefit is larger. So I didn't need the money, I didn't draw on it.
And at that age, you could also still work and draw as much as you want.
Exactly. So in Russia, I mean, 90% of the population are against this change, just like 90% of Americans would be against raising the pension age. So Putin is taking a big hit. His popularity ratings have dropped a full 10% in 3 weeks.
That's huge.
It's huge. Well, it's huge relatively
for him,
speaking.
For him, it's huge.
Well, it's like saying a 400-pound guy lost 50 pounds. I mean, he had popularity ratings of around 80.
But he was used to it going up.
It's been steady since Crimea, over 80. So, but here's the thing, and let's pull the pieces together. He's got something at stake with this meeting with Trump as well. If it goes badly for Putin, and it might, it isn't going to help his ratings. Moreover, a sizable chunk of his security people think he shouldn't be going because Trump's completely untrustworthy. And no deal made there will be worth anything the day after because they observe Trump as carefully as we do. He's unpredictable, shall we say.
Right.
So Putin is not this despot who can just go and have a big failure and go home without any consequence. He's got a politics. But the reason I mentioned the pension thing is that the bedrock of his support has been, since he came to power in 2000, that he saved the Russian people from the economic catastrophe of the 1990s. People have gotten used to a better life, better salaries, better consumer market, more disposable income, and above all, Russians cherish their pension, early retirement. Now Putin's saying, look, we're all living longer. We need more investment in the economy for your kids. Same discussion we have here.
Yeah.
Absolutely identical. But the Russian people, 90% are against even raising it 1 year.
Yeah, they want it lower.
Well, they're not going to get it lower. They know that. But, you know, we all get used to what we live with.
Yeah.
We live for 20 years with something, and we're all concerned.
And if you take it away, you get upset.
We get upset. So he's got a political problem. And they're worried a little bit about whatever they decide with Trump and announce it. They hope its expiration date isn't 48 hours. I mean, they say this in the newspapers, so I'm not making this stuff up.
Is he just got reelected, didn't he? Vladimir Putin did?
In March, yeah.
So is this it? Is this it for terms?
Well, technically, you know, the Russian Constitution says that our Constitution says you cannot serve more than two terms.
Yeah.
The Russian Constitution is different. It says you cannot serve more than two successive terms. So you'll remember Putin served, well, it was then an 8-year term.
And then he stepped out. Medvedev went in.
Medvedev sat in. That was Obama's pal. And then Putin came back, and he's now in his second 6-year term. So technically, this is his last term. It's 6 years. He was asked the other day, are you going to find a way to remain president after your term expires? And he says, what do you want, me to be here at 100 years old? And so he dismissed it.
Well, and he's one of the world's richest persons, isn't he?
I actually don't know.
That's what I hear.
I hear it, too, but I never say what I don't know, and that I don't know. There's a rumor. Let me put it to you like this. Every Russian ruler since the end of the Soviet Union has enriched himself and all his entourage by millions or billions,
sure,
without exception.
I think you could say that about any leader on this planet.
Well, the only thing is that our people tend to do it when they leave office.
When they leave office, yes.
The gripe against the Russian elite is they do it while they're in office.
How do they get away with that?
It's a sort of a Russian tradition. A couple books have been written about one of the old Russian bureaucracy before the revolution, the Tsarist bureaucracy. It didn't pay very well, but bureaucrats had a license to live off the people, extract bribes, and, you know, operate in corrupt ways. It was a long Russian tradition. It passed into the Soviet era, and it survived the Soviet Union. But things are getting better. I mean, not great, but there's less corruption in Russia. I assume Putin is a very wealthy man. But, you know, when people see him with helicopters, airplanes, ships, and all this, those aren't his personal property. Those are the perks of the state. Trump doesn't own Air Force One.
Right.
When he leaves, Air Force One remains with the next president. And that's true of Camp David. I don't think he ever goes there. But, you know, all the things that come with the
president.
Sure. You know, Putin is not this corrupt. I mean, the image we get.
Well, who's behind? Who's behind the apparent nerve gas of these people? A lady just died. Could have been an accident, but
yeah,
it was that same nerve gas that got the other couple.
The British government's lab announced that they think it's the same one, but they can't confirm it yet.
Who's doing it?
It is. Well, let's go back to the original one when this guy Skripal and his daughter.
And they survived it.
Well, that's what makes it all curious, doesn't it? By all accounts of the British government, it was this Novichok, which is said to be absolutely lethal, not only to the people who encounter it directly, but anybody near them. Lethal within an hour or two.
Jeez.
Both survived.
They both survived.
So what was this thing? There are so many mysteries about this story. And then I guess this couple, both of them had addiction problems. We're living in addiction facilities. We're scrounging around parks in London looking for cigarette butts or stuff people have thrown away. And British doctors say, as addicts, their immune system were already...
It's gone.
...were already shot. And so it wouldn't have taken a lethal nerve gas to kill him. So we don't know. It's a mystery.
All right, Stephen, hold on for a sec. We're already at the top of the hour. Let's come back. We'll talk more about this, and we'll take phone calls next. Plus, later on tonight, we're talking superstitions.